With support from Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, with the Summerfest 2004 repertory season of The Glass Menagerie, Guilty Conscience, and Parfumerie, currently playing in the Studio Theater. For information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 800-KCPATIX, 800-527-2849, or visit krannertcenter.com.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Jason Croft is at the controls. This morning, we are reaching into the Focus 580 archives for the program, so that means that today we are not taking calls. The show that you're about to hear was first broadcast on June 2nd. In this part of Focus 580, we will bring you the story of one of the CIA's most important Cold War spies. He was a colonel in the Polish army named Ryszard Kuklinski. He opposed bitterly the Soviet domination of Poland and believed that the only way that he could help his country was to work against the Soviets. And over a period of about 10 years, he provided more than 40,000 pages of classified Soviet documents, things that had to do with the Soviet military and defense. He provided all that to the United States. Then after that, he became concerned that the government there in Poland would discover what he was doing, and asked to be relocated. And in fact, he and his family were brought to the United States, where he lived here until just recently. He just passed away a couple of months ago. At that time, George Tenet, director of the Central Intelligence Agency, said that Colonel Kuklinski was a true hero of the Cold War, to whom we all owe an everlasting debt of gratitude. The story is told in a recently published book titled A Secret Life. The subtitle is The Polish Officer, His Covert Mission, and the Price He Paid to Save His Country. It's published by Public Affairs Books by our guest for this part of Focus 580, Benjamin Weiser. He's a reporter for the New York Times, has been with the paper since 1997. For most of that time, he covered the federal courthouse in Manhattan, including the trial of four men convicted in the 1998 bombings of two American embassies in East Africa. He is now doing investigative reporting for the paper. Before going to work for the Times, he was a reporter at the Washington Post and worked there for 18 years. And it was during the time he was at the Post that he first met and wrote about Colonel Kuklinski, the subject of the book. Mr. Weiser, hello.
How are you doing, David?
I'm fine. Thanks.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. Yeah. You explain in the book that you first met Colonel Kuklinski in 1992, no doubt, from what little you heard about him before you had a chance to talk with him and then spent a lot of time talking with him, I'm sure you thought, this is a great story. That was what attracted you. On his part, do you think, why was he interested in talking with you and having the story of what he did become common knowledge?
You're absolutely right. When I first learned about Kuklinski, and I actually learned about him initially by reading a couple paragraphs about him in a book, I thought this was an amazing story, and I wanted to learn more. And I wrote him a letter, and not knowing quite how to reach him, I wrote it care of the CIA. And of course, they were protecting the colonel who was living under a different identity in the United States. And I said I had an open mind, would love to hear his story and what had motivated him to essentially cross the line, to betray the communist leadership of Poland in an effort to, in his mind, work against the Soviets and to cooperate, of course, with the United States. And I think from his perspective, for reasons which we go into a lot of detail in the book, he felt that his side of this story had not been told, and he was willing to talk to me fairly openly and candidly, and we began a discussion that initially resulted in some articles in the Washington Post and later in the book.
Well, one of the interesting parts of the story is how it is people in Poland felt and continue to wrestle with how they want to think about him. He had been convicted in absentia of treason during the time that Poland still had a communist government. He was actually sentenced to death, a sentence that was later reduced to 25 years. And even once the communist government was gone, people weren't really quite sure how they felt about him. Where technically, I suppose, he was a traitor, but a lot of people would have had looked at his motivation and say that it was patriotism that motivated him to do what he did. He never accepted any money for what he did. How do people in Poland today think about him?
You're absolutely right. There's been an ongoing debate about what Kuklinski did. That debate, to some extent, sparked by enormous criticism of what he did by the communist regime back in the early 1980s and continuing. General Jaruzelski, the leader of Poland and in effect Kuklinski's boss, felt that Kuklinski had betrayed the Polish army by deciding to cooperate with the CIA against the Soviets. But Kuklinski was convinced that he had done the right thing, that if anybody was betraying Poland, it was the communist leadership of Poland and, of course, the Soviets. Kuklinski's motivation to begin cooperating, and we can talk about this, was that he was convinced that in any war in Europe in which the Soviets attacked and moved westward across Europe, the United States could only respond with nuclear weapons, and those weapons would fall right on Poland. Mm-hmm. And he thought to himself, you know, what does Poland get out of this? It's pretty straightforward. In Poland, there has been quite a debate. When Kuklinski was exfiltrated, that's the word the CIA uses for moving him out of Poland just in advance of when he thought he would be arrested in 1981, the Polish government, after discovering what he had done and the material that he had turned over to the United States, did try him in absentia and convicted him of treason, sentenced him to death. That sentence was later reduced to 25 years in prison, but for Kuklinski it was effectively a life sentence. And he remained a wanted man. And I think one reason he felt that he wanted to talk to me was that he didn't feel his voice was being heard and his side of why he decided to, what had motivated him to cooperate. In Poland, the debate has continued, and to some extent does continue today, with many of the old communist generals still believing he is a traitor to Poland. But there's a great swell of support as well on the other side, believing that he did the patriotic thing. Mm.
Well, this must have also been felt as a very personal betrayal by General Jaruzelski, because Kuklinski was close. I don't know if the men were personally close, but professionally they were close.
That's right. Kuklinski initially was a rising officer. In fact, he was a rising officer and ultimately became a colonel on the Polish general staff, which was sort of the nerve center of the Polish military. But it was also, in Kuklinski's role, the nerve center of the Warsaw Pact. Kuklinski had become sort of a trusted liaison for Jaruzelski with Moscow, where the Warsaw Pact command was based. And you'll know the Warsaw Pact, of course, was the Soviet Union and its Eastern European allied countries, which included Poland. And Kuklinski was always flying between Poland and Moscow and the other Soviet allies, meeting with his counterparts, learning what was going on. And Jaruzelski completely trusted him, as did other top Polish leaders, and they did feel a personal betrayal by him.
Well, just to you've talked about his motivation, but just to touch on that just a little bit more, it seemed that very clearly he bitterly resented the Soviet domination of his country. He had seen the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia and was unhappy about that and Polish involvement in that. And then also there was this bottom line issue was he had seen the planning for the next war. He knew what that would be like. And he had to believe that no matter what happened, no matter whether the Soviet Union or the United States prevailed, Poland was in the middle, was in between the two, and felt that even if the Soviet Union won, it wouldn't matter, that no matter what the outcome was, that Poland would be devastated by the war. And he felt that that was one thing that if he could do something to keep that war from happening, that he would do it.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's interesting in the reaction to people who've read this book. There are many Poles who had a similar experience as Kuklinski, perhaps even in your audience in the Chicago area. Kuklinski was 9 years old when the Nazis invaded his country and his city, and he remembers it vividly. He lost his father in the concentration camps. He himself, as a teenager, was in slave labor camps in Poland. And eventually, after the war, Kuklinski decided that the way he could make a mark was to join the Polish army. And his dream, perhaps naive at the time, was that that was how he could make Poland strong after seeing what had happened in World War II. But of course, the Soviet Union takes over the army, and the story begins again. And in fact, Kuklinski lived almost his entire adult life in a country that was never being run by Poles. And you're absolutely right. By 1960, he had joined the general staff, was a rising officer in the army. In 68, he found himself in the middle of the Czech invasion. Poland sent a contingent of troops in that invasion, and he was part of the monitoring of their communications. He was repulsed by what was going on and just horrified that Poland would be participating in an invasion of its neighbor. In 1970, he was repulsed again when he learned that the Polish army had been ordered to fire and killed striking workers on the Polish coast. And in 1972, he finally decided, and in a few years before that he had to take some step, some concrete action. And as you pointed out, he had gotten high enough in his job to really have a sense of the real secrets. And the most important secret he learned was that the Soviet Union's war plan for Europe was offensive in nature, not defensive. And Kuklinski reached out to America. He was in Northern Europe on a what you might call a business trip. He and several other officers were making a surveillance mission through the canals and rivers and ports of Northern Europe, pretending to be tourists. But during this trip, Kuklinski wrote a very short letter in broken English to the American military attaché at the embassy in Bonn. I might add, he was not reaching out to the CIA, and he himself, of course, was not an intelligence officer. He was an army officer, and he wanted to talk to an army officer, an American officer. And as he told me later, he knew that America was the only country that could really help him in a case like this and help Poland and had the strength and the wherewithal to do it. And he offered the United States at the time a somewhat, in retrospect, a naive idea, which was that he believed there were Poles in the general staff who, along with him, would be willing to conspire secretly against the Soviet Union if there was an unprovoked attack by Moscow, and wanted the Americans to help them do that. And the American officers who went to meet him, and they were CIA officers posing as army officers because the CIA wanted Kuklinski to believe he was meeting with American military, said, that's crazy. This will not work, and you'll all be arrested within days. They proposed to him a different idea, which was that he stay in place, and as he rose over the years, he would provide the United States with as much information as he could about the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact militaries. And within the first year, Kuklinski began turning over extraordinary documents, and including key elements of the Soviet war plans for Western Europe and Central Europe. So he established his bona fides right away, but his motivation, he believed, was straightforward. It was, how do I work against the Soviet Union and how do I free my country?
Yeah, it's interesting that in a way I think that he, rather than thinking that he was working for the United States, in a way I think he believed that the United States was working for him.
That's right. He always joked, his critics always said, well, the CIA recruited you to work for them. And he said, no, in fact, it's the other way around. I recruited the CIA to work for me in Poland.
Our guest is Benjamin Weiser. He's a reporter for the New York Times, has been Metropolitan reporter there since 1997. Before that, worked for the Washington Post. The book, if you're interested in reading the story, is titled A Secret Life, and it's published by Public Affairs. Just to go, I know we're kind of bouncing around here, but just to go back for a second, because you mentioned the fact that Kuklinski's father had died in a Nazi concentration camp. Some people hearing that might leap to the assumption that Kuklinskis were Jewish. They were not. They were Catholic. But his father was involved in the resistance against the Nazis in Warsaw and did have connections to the Jewish community there in Warsaw.
That's exactly right. Kuklinski actually lived, he was an only child, and he and his parents lived right outside the ghetto. In fact, they lived in the ghetto, what became the ghetto and moved outside. But his father was a member of the underground, and Kuklinski remembers, not realizing what he was doing, but carrying food to his father, who worked as a business, was sort of helping manage a building that was inside the ghetto, and carrying food to him, which Kuklinski learned was being given to starving Jews inside. And I might add, Kuklinski has always pointed out to me that, his experience is not unique. I mean, so many Poles, we forget how many Poles were killed in the concentration camps as well.
How did, I guess in a way, I guess you've answered this question because it has to do with right away the information that he provided to the United States. But I'm sure that initially the United States government had to figure out was this guy on the level or not, or was the other side setting him up to feed us disinformation? I'm sure that's one of the first things that you have to think about when someone offers himself as a double agent. How did they sort out that he was who he said he was, and that, you know, when he said, look, the reason I'm doing this is essentially I oppose Soviet control of my country. I'm working against the Soviets. I'm going to provide you with the information. How did they determine that he was indeed who he said he was?
Exactly. The simple answer is that the material Kuklinski turned over in the first few months of exchanges with the Warsaw station, the CIA station in Warsaw in 1972, were of such magnitude that they could not have been that they weren't disinformation. First of all, they clearly were not, and also they were too important for the Soviets to give over in any kind of, you know, operation which was designed to mislead the United States in some sort of double agent. Of course, whenever somebody walks in, and Kuklinski, like any volunteer, is the term they use is a walk-in, there's always the question of who is he. And one of the things that fascinated me in my reporting was going back to the original people who got Kuklinski's first letter in Germany and back in Washington and how they responded to it. And there was question that they weren't sure who he was, and there were some people in the CIA who said, you know, we don't need another Eastern European seaman. He had come over on a boat and had indicated his sailing itinerary. But others said, you know, let's see what he has to say and let's send somebody out. And it was a very interesting time in CIA history. For just a few years earlier, James Angleton, the head of counterintelligence, had pretty much said that any walk-in coming over to the United States or offering information about the Soviet Union could not be trusted and should be sent back. And, of course, years later, the CIA was penetrated by people like Ames, and many of our sources were killed. Kuklinski luckily came at a moment in between those two, and so he was listened to and ultimately proved that he could be believed.
As you mentioned, when he made his contact with the United States, he and a number of other Polish officers were on a sailboat, and they were disguised as tourists, but what they were doing was they were trying to collect some information and posing as tourists. And this was apparently he loved to sail and was a good sailor, and this was an old Nazi sailboat that had been wrecked in World War II that he actually rebuilt to do this. And so he and these other guys were sailing and trying to collect information. He actually had one of his children with him. So it makes you wonder how he thought about the risk that not only he was taking, but that the risk that his family took indirectly, because they didn't know what he was doing.
That's right. I mean, he, just to clarify one thing, the boat that he rebuilt was actually not the boat they went sailing.
Oh, I thought it was the same boat.
I think that's not it. I'll have to check. I'm trying to.
You should know.
But he did rebuild a boat, but what he had done on the general staff, he had gathered together a group of about a dozen officers, and he went to his bosses and said, you know, we have all these military maps of Northern and Western Europe, but we've never actually seen these places, and wouldn't be a bad idea to go over there, and we'll pose as tourists. And the Poles loved the idea, and for several years he was able to do that, and it became a wonderful cover for his meetings with the Americans. Because it was a tourist trip, ostensibly, he did take his son along, and it was a trip in which people went sightseeing and shopping, and that was mostly what they were doing, but it gave him great opportunities to sneak out and to go see the Americans.
How did he manage to keep what he was doing from his family?
Kuklinski had two sons and his wife, and his wife clearly was aware that he was doing something, and as he's told me and is in the book, he gave her a bit of a cover story without telling her precisely what he was doing. It would have been too dangerous for her to know that he was meeting secretly and providing information to American CIA officers in Warsaw, which is in fact what he was doing. And to protect her and the family, he kept that a secret. He told her that he was in fact meeting secretly with some American friends who he had met during a short stay that he had had in Vietnam. Kuklinski had been a member of a Polish delegation to Vietnam during the Vietnam War to monitor the implementation of the Geneva Accords, and he did see American troops up close, and this became a plausible cover. It still was a dangerous thing to do, and his wife kept it a secret. His sons were unaware of what he did, although there were several times when I think they came close to understanding it, but they never told him anything that made him think that they knew, and they were very loyal to him.
At the beginning, I mentioned the fact that he had, over this period of about 10 years, had provided an enormous volume of information to the United States, and that he had access to this sort of a war planning information at a very high level, Soviet war planning information. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about what it is that the United States learned as a result of having him providing us with this information.
Exactly. Kuklinski did provide us, as you've said, roughly 40-some thousand Soviet language documents over 9 years. And these were, as CIA officers told me later, sort of the touchstone, the most extraordinary material that we had had during this period on the Soviet military and the Warsaw Pact. This included, but not limited to, information about, you know, highly classified Soviet weapons systems such as the T-72 tank, at a time when we really didn't have information about it, on Soviet air defenses, and also on secret bunkers that the Soviet Union was building in Poland, Bulgaria, and Russia, where the Soviet high command would be placed during a war. And of course, there was the war plan, the key elements of the war plans themselves. And then in the latter years, 1980, 81, and for what Kuklinski is probably best known for, in 1980, at the end of 1980, the Soviet Union had troops poised outside Poland, and there was great fear in the White House and in Poland that the Soviets were going to invade Poland, this being the result of the Solidarity Movement that had just begun several months earlier in Gdansk, and great fears in the Soviet and the communist leadership of Poland about the threat that posed. And it's sometimes hard to remember how tense a time that was, but there was great fear in the United States about a Soviet invasion. It got to the point that the White House, President Carter, got on the hotline and actually told Brezhnev, told the Kremlin that they better watch out. Kuklinski got information to the United States in early January about the readiness of Soviet troops to invade, with the specific numbers of troops, where they would come, what countries they were coming from, and he passed that along to the United States. And the United States then went public with that information on the weekend it arrived in Washington, and again warned the Soviets of the serious consequences an invasion would lead to. And there was no invasion. And then again in 1981, Kuklinski provided the U.S. with the Soviet, with the communist leadership of Poland's secret plans to crush Solidarity, the ultimate crackdown with martial law that did happen. Kuklinski gave the United States the running up-to-date information on how that was going to happen. One reason he had access to it was that he was so trusted on the general staff that he had been placed in charge of helping to coordinate the Army's role in the crackdown on Solidarity.
Mm. And here again, maybe one of those cases where it explains why it is that some people in Poland might have mixed feelings about Kuklinski, is that he had this information about the preparation for the crackdown, imposing martial law, the crackdown on Solidarity. He told the United States, but he did not inform the leadership of Solidarity.
It's a fascinating debate. Neither he, of course, went public with it, nor did the United States. And in some respects, given the sensitivity of what Kuklinski was doing, it might have been more logical for the White House to go public. But the White House did not, and neither did he. And by all accounts, the reason was pretty straightforward. The fear, and Kuklinski felt this, was that if it had become publicized, if Solidarity had been warned that the crackdown was coming with the specific information that Kuklinski had, he was convinced it would have led to bloodshed, that it could not have led to anything positive and only would have been a worse situation. Kuklinski, was not in a position himself to go public, and it's been something which people have debated, whether he could have stepped forward and gone public and said, here's what I know is about to happen, and people should take cover and react. But, in a way, I mean, Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski, the former national security advisor, in a recent talk at a memorial service for Kuklinski, said, I have a little note here, he says, it is sometimes suggested that he should have joined Solidarity and gone public. And he said that would have been an act of folly, for he would have been exposed, and it would have been an ineffective act because it wouldn't have contributed to the forestalling of the strategic plans that the Soviets were developing. And there was no there was no logic to that. Kuklinski was an army officer, and his value remained in his remaining secret. But it is something that's been debated and probably continues to be.
And certainly it was true that he was sympathetic to Solitary, was supporting of those aims. So he was definitely with them, ideologically speaking, but he seemed to think that maybe withholding that information, as you say, was something that he could do to prevent a lot of bloodshed and loss of life.
That's right. And I mean, one of the most extraordinary documents I got was a letter Kuklinski wrote to the CIA in just the weeks before the crackdown. In the last few weeks he was in Poland. And here he is, an army officer in the communist regime, and he writes, "Long live Solidarity."
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Benjamin Weiser. He's a reporter for The New York Times and has been there at the Times since 1977. He's a Metropolitan reporter. He's covered legal issues and terrorism. Before going to work at the Times, he spent 18 years as a reporter for The Washington Post, where he served on the investigative staff. And it was during the time that he was working for The Post that he first met Richard Kuklinski, the man we're talking about here this morning. If you're interested in reading the story in greater depth, you can look for the book. It's titled A Secret Life, and the subtitle is The Polish Officer, His Covert Mission, and the Price He Paid to Save His Country. Public Affairs is the publisher on the book. It was just right around the time that we've been talking about here, late in 1981, I believe, that that Kuklinski began to think that maybe the government was onto him, or there was some possibility that he might be uncovered, and that was the point that he asked the United States to help him get out. What was it that made him suspect that possibly his cover was about to be blown?
Kuklinski, in the fall of 1981, was right in the middle of the planning for martial law. And one day he was called to the office of one of his superiors and arrives and sees the superior general sitting there with a white face and several colleagues sitting around the table. And this was the small group of people who were most privy to what was actually happening in the behind the scenes in Poland. And the general used the word Langley. He said Langley has the martial law plans, and that the Poles had learned this from Rome sources, from Soviet sources in Rome. There was not much more detail about where the information was coming from, but Kuklinski knew that the end was near because he was one of two officers, as I recall, who actually had a full set of the martial law plans in his safe. And so he was convinced that any investigation would not take long to track, to narrow its focus to him. And in the archive of this case, one of the fascinating parts of the book, in my mind, or the reporting, was I was able to get a lot of the internal archives of the agency, of the CIA, of this case. And one of the letters Kuklinski wrote that night to the agency said, everything is pointing to the end of my mission. And indeed, it wasn't long after that the CIA began a process to move him out.
Maybe just here, it'd be a good opportunity for me to have you talk about your relationship with the CIA. I think we want to be clear that the book was in no way authorized by the CIA or reviewed by the CIA, or they did not participate directly, at least, in your work.
That's right. As I mentioned earlier, I did a couple articles for the Washington Post in 1992 and then decided it would be very interesting to do a book. Kuklinski told me that he was not intending to do his own book, and I thought it was a story that, obviously Poles might want to read, but I actually think Americans need to know this story. It's a fascinating look to me at a man who was inspired by, Western values and culture and to do what he did. And I actually asked the CIA, I said, I, through their public affairs office, like any journalist would, I said, I would love to have the internal archive of this case, the letters Kuklinski wrote, the tape-recorded meetings he had. My goal was to get a contemporaneous account of what he was telling the agency, what they were telling him. Everything I had written up to that point was based on his memory and others. I might add, his memory is pretty good, it turned out, but I wanted to have that in print, in a sense. And the agency has a policy that allows employees and others who want to write about either their experiences or access to agency material to do so, but you've got to get a security clearance, you have to get approval, and you have to submit the final book for a review by the agency to make sure that there's nothing in it that they don't want to have published. And I can understand that process, but it didn't seem to me to be the way a journalist should go about doing it. And I eventually came up with a compromise in which a former CIA officer who had worked in the public affairs office and who was generally trusted by reporters and is a very straightforward person, but also a very respected officer in his own group, agreed to work for me. He was retired as a freelance researcher, and he went into the files and answered my questions, took notes, and provided me with a good account of what had happened. Because most of the people who were involved in this case on all sides were still alive, I then began the interviewing process and simply used the material from the agency as a kind of reporting tool. My goal was to make the agency not my editor, but my source. And I was able, I felt, to fill in many of the blanks by interviewing not only Kuklinski, of course, but many of the officers who had worked with him and who were happy to talk about the case, too.
How much time did you spend with Kuklinski?
We spent, in the initial weeks back in 1992, we spent several weeks actually sitting down and meeting. And Kuklinski talked. I had my tape recorder running, and it gave me an initial sense of everything he had done, and it was quite fascinating. Over the years, we met many times. We spoke on the phone endlessly, and our conversations continued, and our meetings continued through pretty much the 1990s as I continued to collect the archival material and do interviewing with different people. And then we spent many, many hours on the phone as the book was being written and towards the very end.
We have a caller here we'll bring into the conversation, and other people who are listening, if you have questions, you can certainly call in, talk with our guest, Benjamin Weiser. 333-9455 is the line here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Peoria and on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
My name is Andy Klejcik, and I was wondering when, if ever, it became apparent to the colonel that the Soviet Union was losing the Cold War, and if you can, explain what the circumstances were.
Kuklinski, to his great credit, I think, was a man ahead of his time in the sense that he believed from the start that Soviet domination of Poland and the rest of Eastern Europe was not a fait accompli. It was not something that had to be forever. He was convinced that ultimately could change. There are many people who would say that's naive, but in retrospect, he was right. And I think he knew from the start, because he was so privy to what was really not only going on in his country and in the Warsaw Pact, but he understood conceptually how a war would be fought. And he knew how the Soviets could be sabotaged. He actually, part of what made him so good as an officer was that he had been a great and very precise map maker. He understood how war exercises were being done. He was the leading author of Warsaw Pact exercises for many years and helped develop them and knew intimately how, every road and canal and bridge was going to play into it. So he believed that things could be, that all was not lost if done correctly in a war. Of course, he had no idea that the Soviet Union would ultimately fall as it did, but he believed it could, and he actually, in some of his writings to the CIA in the 1970s that I obtained, he talked about the possibility that the Soviets might have their domination ended.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Obviously, the caller is may be thinking about the criticism that has been made of the CIA and intelligence generally in the United States, that it failed to predict the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, yeah. One thing about this case that, I find interesting, this isn't why I wrote the book, but one of the reasons that the subject was interesting to me was how the CIA ran a human intelligence operation. I mean, the central story in this book is what motivated Kuklinski to cross the line. Why does somebody in his early 40s, who's a thriving, rising star in a good job in Poland at that time, decide to, potentially throw it all away and take the step he did? But another side was, how does the CIA respond when somebody like that comes knocking on the door? And as I mentioned in the introduction, and I might add, this is a time today when the need for human intelligence perhaps has never been more obvious as we look towards Iraq and the world and the fight on terrorism and things like that. Mm-hmm. But this story, we have to remember the CIA is the, as I wrote in the book, is the face America first offers people who, like Kuklinski, are inspired by Western ideals. And to the extent that the agency is unable to carry out such operations. You know, I think the U.S. and the West loses a powerful means of understanding nations and regimes and groups that are hostile to the West. So, you know, we were lucky in a way that Kuklinski found us.
I keep thinking about what it must have been like for him for this period now of close to 10 years, knowing that it was possible that any moment he could have been exposed and that it would destroy his family. I'm sure he would have had every expectation that he would have been arrested and executed. How did he all that time live with that pressure and that fear that something like that could happen?
You know, the CIA, when they began responding to Kuklinski and began a relationship that lasted 9 years, you know, they knew that Kuklinski could not confide in anyone. He couldn't talk to his friends, obviously. He couldn't talk to his family, or he risked arrest and worse. And the CIA assigned an officer whose code name was Daniel in the book, a very interesting officer who was exactly Kuklinski's age. His actual name is David Forden, to become the case officer of the case. And Daniel basically was in charge of the case for many years and began a correspondence with Kuklinski. In their first meetings, he told Kuklinski, "Feel free to write to me," and he gave him a pen. And these letters were written in, you know, in the same kind of secret communications that Kuklinski was using for sending his documents across. But one of the things Kuklinski, you know, it's clear from reading these letters that Kuklinski is under constant tension for 9 years, a kind of tension that is very hard to understand unless you've been there. In most of the period of time that this operation occurred, Kuklinski had no contact with the Americans except for very quick exchanges in the darkness on streets through carefully orchestrated meetings with officers who were working with the CIA, who were attached to the American embassy in Warsaw under diplomatic cover, as if they were State Department officers. And it was terrifying. And there were times, there were very close calls. There was one moment when Kuklinski was literally photographing documents in his office, and an officer, a Polish officer, just walked in, you know, unexpectedly. And Kuklinski had to move extremely fast to turn the little miniature camera in his hand that was made to look like a lighter, to effectively transform it into a lighter so he could light a cigarette. And it was almost a sleight of hand that he had to use. But it was that kind of thing.
You told the story a little bit earlier of how this was in late 1981. He walks into this military meeting, and the superior there said the United States knows about the martial law plan, and he, Kuklinski, knew that there were only two people who had the complete plan. There was another guy. There was him. And he thought that, well, this is getting too close, the possibility that he could be discovered. And so he notified the United States that the mission had to end, and they had to get him and his family out. How did they do that? How did the United States do that?
It was quite an operation. Kuklinski had a method of signaling the CIA station in Warsaw through some chalk marks, and he did that and called for a brief exchange in the night that he learned of the leak of the martial law plans, and the agency sent an officer out to meet him. It happened that the chief officer in Poland, the so-called station chief, was out of town in Berlin, and the deputy, a young woman who had been in Poland for a few years, was sent out to meet Kuklinski. And she told him, "I can get you out of here now, or if you want to bring your family, it's going to take a few days." And Kuklinski, of course, would not leave without at least offering his family the opportunity to go with him. But there was a very risky and really a dangerous week of attempts and failed attempts to get him out. The Poles at this time were surveilling American diplomats very closely. They were following cars as closely as they could of any diplomat leaving the embassy, making it almost impossible for officers to get out to meet with Kuklinski, much less actually get him out of Poland. It was quite an operation, but we detail it in a lot of in detail in the book. Eventually, the agency had to send an officer from outside the country to swoop in with his car in a very dramatic move to take him from a particular meeting point to the American embassy, and then had to turn around and get him from the American embassy out of the country.
When he finally sat down with his family and told them that for the previous 9 years, or however long it was, he had been spying for the United States, how did they react?
It was a moment that's very hard to imagine. But Kuklinski's wife, of course, had a sense that he was meeting with Americans, and when he told her what he had been doing, she pledged total loyalty and said, "Of course, we're going to come with you. You know, you're not going anywhere without us." One of his sons, his younger son, said, "I will follow you anywhere," and said he would be happy to go. His other son, an older son, a very intellectual young man, gave it some thought and at first demurred and wondered why and how the Americans could be trusted after getting over his initial shock at what his father had said. But Kuklinski reminded his son that the Americans had never abandoned people. They don't abandon them on the battlefield, and they wouldn't abandon the family either. And in the end, all four family members went together. Kuklinski's family played a very important role in his life, and he was a very devoted father and husband. In one of the letters that he wrote to the CIA just weeks again before this final exfiltration, but before he knew that he would have to leave, he sort of reviewed the 9 years of his operation, and it was now about a year or so after Solidarity had begun, and the burgeoning revolution was making him feel much better about what he was doing. I'll just read this brief part of the letter. He says in the letter that when he leaves to meet with the CIA, he wonders sometimes if he says, "I believe that my family never suspects that when I leave on my risky short meetings that I bid them a discreet farewell. Every time I find it difficult to conceal my happiness when all goes well and I return safely." But then he wrote, "Despite all this, I have boundless faith in the rightness of what I am doing. Nobody and nothing could possibly change my mind or lead me off the chosen path." After August 1980, which of course was the creation of Solidarity, he says, "I was additionally convinced that I am not alone traveling the road, that the nation desires freedom from the shackles of communism imposed from the outside. After all, today I am able to do more for this country, for the cause of freedom, than 9 years ago." That's, of course, when he had begun the operation. And he concludes by saying, "From the effort of individuals, the strength of a nation is formed, against which even the greatest power is powerless." And that writing, which I thought was quite beautiful, which was never intended to be public, it was just a letter he had written to Daniel in their secret communications, I think really says it all. It made clear that that he really believed change could occur, that he saw himself doing it one way, that Solidarity was doing it another way, and in the end, the change did occur.
We have a caller here in Indiana, Lake Station, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I remember reading the obituary in the New York Times earlier in the year, so I'm happy to hear this program. I have two questions for you. When was the last time you had a conversation with Kuklinski?
I spoke with Kuklinski, my recollection is, in late January or early February, right before his death, by telephone.
Uh-huh. Did he give you any of his thoughts on this current situation that the United States is now embroiled in?
Which current situation?
The one in Iraq.
He was, not in detail. I mean, we talked about a lot of things, but at that particular conversation and in recent conversations I had right before that, we were not focusing on that specifically. We were really just talking about the book, and it was just coming out. He actually did have a chance to read the book and liked it. And then, as you know, and not everybody may, but he then suffered a massive stroke in early February and passed away. But the simple answer is I don't really have an answer for you on that.
In the course of chatting with him about his thoughts of Poland, Russia, and so forth, did he give you an opportunity did he express his thoughts on the wider history of Poland and how it came to bear on his specific thinking regarding the Soviets?
Well, I think he felt, as so many Poles do, that his country, simply had to be free, that Poland for too long in too many forms was being dominated and run by outside powers, and then predating even the Cold War of our time, that's not unique to Kuklinski, that point of view. So many Poles hated the Russians, and Kuklinski himself told me that Polish officers on the Polish general staff were always talking badly about the Soviets, and some didn't really were equally enraged at what was happening to their own country. Kuklinski took a step that none of the others did, but I think in some ways he was a typical Pole who really believed, who loved his country, and and found the way to carry out that was to, in his view, work against the Soviets.
In the book, does he or do you portray his thoughts about his long-term view of Polish history, starting from the partitions to the time after First World War, during Second World War? Does any of that information come out in your book?
I mean, I think the book does give a sense of his sense of Polish history. I mean, this is not a book about Polish history. It's a book about Kuklinski, and he was he grew up, as we say, he was born in 1930, but he understood Polish history. He was a real, you know, to some extent, an intellectual in the military, and fully understood the fact that his country never seemed to be able to, you know, to be independent, and during times that it was being dominated, that in many ways Poles were resisting, you know, their subservient role. He told me, and I actually put this in the introduction, in my first meeting with him, you know, he said, I asked myself at the beginning if I had the moral right to do this, to sort of break and to betray the communist leadership. He said, I was a Pole. I understood that Poles should be free and that the United States was the only country that might support the fight for freedom in Poland. On the other hand, I was providing so much information, and there will always be this question of whether a human being has the right, based on his own individual decision, particularly if the interests of the whole country and maybe the lives of millions are involved. And he said it was a dilemma, my moral dilemma, but I became convinced that I not only had the right, I had the moral obligation. I don't think I fully answered your question, but I think he did have a real sense of Polish history, and I think he had a sense of where he fit in it.
Yeah, you did well. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for
the
call. Oh, we're here down to the point where we have a couple of minutes left. We talked about the fact that he and his family left in 1981, left Poland and came to the United States, and he lived there until just earlier this year when he died in February. What was his life like here in the United States in those years?
Kuklinski, of course, upon his arrival in the United States and his family's arrival, things, you know, a new life began that none of them had expected, certainly none of them, but Kuklinski had ever anticipated might happen. They had to learn English. They had to adopt, with the CIA's assistance, completely new identities in the United States and then lived under those identities, particularly in jeopardy during the period of time when there was still a warrant out for Kuklinski's arrest in Poland. And as we've talked about earlier, the trial occurred in Poland, and Kuklinski, you know, largely remained silent in the United States, although he did write one piece for a Polish emigre journal called Kultura, which he tried to explain his motivation back in the mid-1980s as to why he had turned over the martial law plans. It was not until the mid-1990s that the lawyers in Poland began to take up his case and went to the Polish Military Court of Appeals and argued that the case should be overturned, saying that, you know, this was a communist-era conviction, and if Poland truly was a free country, how could it recognize a badge of dishonor put on by the communist leadership? And ultimately, as Poland sought to enter NATO, the Polish ambassador to the United States, Jerzy Kosminski, took up the cause along with people like Dr. Brzezinski and some officials in the Clinton administration and pretty much helped Poland understand that it would be a pretty good idea if they wanted to get into NATO, that perhaps Kuklinski might be recognized as the first officer of NATO, the first Polish officer of NATO. His life took some tragic turns. He lost both of his sons. Both died tragically, and Kuklinski's health was not the greatest. And to some extent, you know, it was not a great life. But he definitely, I know, felt that he had done the right thing, and happily was able to return to Poland several times in the late 1990s and early 2000s. After all the debate, he went back to somewhat of a hero's welcome. And as recently as last fall, he made a trip back, and I remember him telling me after he returned that for the first time, he had been able to wander out into the streets of Warsaw without security, completely on his own. And people had recognized him and hugged him and embraced him and shook his hand and were very pleasantly surprised to see him, and it made him feel very good.
Yeah, he was made an honorary citizen of Gdańsk.
And Kraków, that's right.
In the late 90s, so obviously they didn't arrest him.
No, they were honoring him.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating story, and of course it is available in much greater depth and detail in the book that we've talked about. Again, it's titled A Secret Life.
published by Public Affairs, by our guest, Benjamin Weiser. He is a Metropolitan reporter for The New York Times. Before that, worked for The Washington Post. So if you're interested in reading the book, you can head out to the bookstore and find it. And Ben, thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. The show was first broadcast on June 2nd. Many Focus programs from the past, also interviews from the Afternoon Magazine. A lot of our local production is available on the website. And you can go there and you can listen anytime you like. It's at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Focus 580, this show, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Monday on the program, we will again be having programs from the archives, and they both have to do with the lives of two very significant Americans. In the first hour, a conversation with Ron Chernow, who's written a book about the man who is arguably the most significant American who was never president. And the person that we're talking about is Alexander Hamilton. Chernow has written a new biography of Hamilton. It's just out this spring. He talked with us a few weeks ago, and if you didn't hear the interview the first time around, well, you'll have the opportunity on Monday in the 10 o'clock hour. Then hour number two, we will turn our attention to Abraham Lincoln, and the guest for that show is Harold Holzer. And we'll be talking about a speech that Abraham Lincoln gave that many people, including Lincoln himself, feel helped to establish him as a potential national candidate. And in fact, maybe it was that speech that made him president. At least Lincoln, a lot of others thought so. The title of the book that Harold Holzer wrote about this is Lincoln at Cooper Union, a speech that was given in New York City by Abraham Lincoln. And that's a fascinating story there. And you will have the opportunity again to hear that, if you didn't the first time around, Monday in the 11 o'clock hour. Then we'll be back live Tuesday morning. Phil Nixon will be with us to have a little session to talk about dealing with household insect pests. And then in hour two, Dave Dessers, the guest, is professor of cinema studies at the U of I. We'll talk about movies. We're here, generally speaking, weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we hope that you'll stay tuned, because coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thanks, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk about dogs with dog trainers Carol Lindholm and Jim Keel. They join us on the first Friday of the month in the 1 o'clock hour to talk about dog care, training, and behavior. They are with the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana. They join us following the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. July wheat trading at 332.5, up 2. September 341, then up 2.5. July corn, 256.25, down 1.25. September, 259.75, down 3.25. December corn, 263.75, down 3.5. March corn, 270.75, down 3.5. July beans, 936.5, up 3. August, 809, up 5.25. November, 654.5, down 13. July meal, 312.50, that up $3 even. July oil, 28.